Welcome to the CSIS podcast. Look the week's news and foreign policy through the eyes of the experts at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Colm Quinn. Now, we often discuss some of the darkest and most intractable problems in world affairs, the mess in Syria and the resulting migration crisis in Europe, to mention just two, but rarely we get to step back and look at a success story. Well, so far, the transition of Myanmar, or Burma, and we'll get to that tricky name at the end, to democracy has been a slow-burning success, with the military junta, who've been in power for 5 decades, slowly beginning to loosen the reins and permit other voices to be heard. And there's been no stronger voice than Aung San Suu Kyi. Freed from her decades-long house arrest, the Nobel Peace Prize winner has taken her party, the National League for Democracy, from strength to strength, culminating in last Sunday's victory in the parliamentary elections, where her party won an absolute majority of seats. It's good news for the US too, as heavy engagement with Myanmar has borne fruit and is a significant win for the Obama administration as it enters its final year. And of course, it's not all celebrations. There's still a big hill for Myanmar to climb. The military still runs key agencies, including the police force, and has a strong hand in the economy. Worse still, the country remains tarnished for its treatment of minorities, including the Rohingya in the north. So this week we talked to Murray Hebert, senior fellow in our Sumitro Chair in Southeast Asian Studies, to talk about the steps Myanmar has taken and its road ahead.
This election has been a long time in the process of being made. As probably everybody knows, in 1988, there's a huge protest. The military crushes it. 1990, Aung San Suu Kyi wins an overwhelming election. She was already in house arrest, never was allowed to take her seat. Then, in the various points, there are protests. 2007-8, there are monks protesting. But ultimately, the things started to change after, in 2010, they had elections. They elected a president. They elected a president who was Thein Sein, who was open to beginning at least part of the reform process, freeing Aung San Suu Kyi from house arrest, calling by-elections so that she and her party could run, launching reforms, freeing the internet, freeing journalists, opening up to the West, United States, Europe, etc. And so then we get to the elections now, and I think most people thought that there would be it would be more problematic, that there would be more stuffed ballot boxes. And it wasn't perfect. Many Muslims weren't allowed to run. And no Muslims were elected. And the Rohingya issue, which was big earlier this year, they're the minority in the far northwest of the country, were not even allowed to vote, even though they had voted in 2010 and in 2012. So it's pretty good news, but it's only the first step in a long transition.
I want to get into the issue of the Rohingya in a moment, but back to this idea of kind of handing over the reins and moving towards a more open society. Aung San Suu Kyi has been a huge icon and a symbol of this, but who else has been involved? Who else can you point to say that, you know, without their help, we wouldn't be looking at what we're looking at now?
Well, there were a lot of political prisoners that ultimately paid a big price for shining the spotlight on what was going on in the country and then pushing for reform. But then since the new government came in, Thein Sein's government, he has allowed some reforms to happen. Also, Shui Man, who was the speaker of the lower house, was instrumental in allowing some reforms to happen and giving the parliament an increasingly important voice and many of the ideas that were implemented came from there. So there's been many cooks in the kitchen here trying to make this happen. The military has roughly behaved itself, hasn't intervened as often as people thought they might. So they've pulled back a little bit, and so in a sense they're players just by not being as active and assertive as they had been before.
I want to talk about the military. How much of the country really does Aung San Suu Kyi's party inherit? How much power does she really get from winning this election?
We're going to have to see. This is going to be a work in progress. But the military still has 25% of the seats in parliament. You need 75% of the parliamentary vote to change the constitution, unless one military guy defects and everybody else votes for a constitutional change. They can't change the constitution. The military controls three of the biggest ministries: defense, the police, and border security. These are really, they control the security apparatus of the country. And so the military is still very influential. And it really, they will now have a courtship dance to try to figure out how they're going to make this work. Aung San Suu Kyi has reached out to the military, has reached out to the president and other players, and they're going to have to negotiate, talk about the transition. Both sides are going to have to be a little bit careful. It's clear the people have spoken overwhelmingly, and they're the biggest victors in this election, really, that they want change. They don't want the military running this country. But if Aung San Suu Kyi and her party try to move too fast, these guys feel that they're being shunted aside unceremoniously. They can fight back. And so it's got to be done with sensitivity so that we keep the ball going forward rather than we get stalled where we are right now.
And let's talk a little bit about Aung San Suu Kyi, a different side of her that, you know, the world knows this icon, this Nobel laureate, but perhaps we'll talk about Aung San Suu Kyi, the politician. How much faith do you have that she can navigate something as complex as a transitional society?
We don't know. She has spent so much time under house arrest. She was a professor before and a scholar, a Tibetan scholar. She comes back and quickly goes in 1988 and quickly ends up spending decades in under house arrest. She doesn't have a very deep bench or deep group of cadre in her party. She makes basically all the decisions. She has people in her party who are like over 82 and under 22. There's not much middle there. Who are going to be her ministers? Is she going to try to find technocrats who live abroad or have lived on the fringes? What are her policies going to be? Whenever I've taken people to meet her, she says, my goal is rule of law. Well, that's really nice, but you can't, you know, you need to have policies that make clear that foreign investors are welcome, how much they're going to open up the economy just generally. And on that note, the economy is still very heavily dominated by the military. They control huge swaths of the economy, and a lot of their so-called cronies, they're the friends of the military junta, the big tycoons, control a lot of the economy. Now, they've tried to open up to her a little bit recently, in recent years, preparing for this election, but are they going to be ready to work with her? It's going to be really, there are a lot of stakeholders in this country, the military, the tycoons, the civil society, with whom she should be able to get along easily. There are Muslims. She did not come out forcefully, despite the fact that she was very badly abused herself, did not come out forcefully in defense of the Muslims or the Rohingya when they were being kicked out of the country earlier this year. So she has become a politician, and we're going to just have to see how well she understands what all has to happen in this transition from political to social policy to economic policy to and then also to relations with foreign countries. That's going to be a huge issue for her to figure out.
Yeah, and traditionally, Myanmar has had a relationship with China and has been supported by China. So with this sort of new look, Myanmar, how would you recommend it navigates its affairs now? Is it a case of getting deeper into ASEAN, perhaps resetting things with China? And additionally, you know, the U.S. has been involved here. The U.S., Obama's been to Myanmar twice in his presidency, and both Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, I believe, have been there as well. How much did the U.S. have influence on what we're seeing now?
Well, I think the U.S. had a big role first in sanctioning the country. And part of the reason for the government wanting reforms is to get out from under the sanctions and get out from under the almost total dominance by China. So they wanted to have a little more wiggle room. To get that wiggle room, they had to find ways to get the West to engage, the United States and the West. They did that by starting reforms, inviting foreign investment. But she will want to try to find a sort of non-aligned or equidistant kind of foreign policy whereby she is going to, yes, be friendly with China. It is its giant neighbor to the north. China has huge influence along the border in the ethnic minority groups, some of whom are still fighting the central government. That China is the biggest investor in Myanmar. It is the biggest trading partner. So China is important. But at the same time, India is on the other side, and India could possibly want to play a bigger role. And Japan is a huge aid donor, official development assistance. Japan has been traditionally very involved in Myanmar. And then the United States. And the United States, some of the most important things the U.S. can bring is capacity building, education, capacity building, helping civil servants figure out how to do a budget or how to run a health ministry. There are a very small cadre of people who can do this. Right at the top, there's almost nobody in the middle. And one of the complaints of people in Myanmar is that the reforms basically hit in the cities, and that once you got out of the cities, there was no officials to really implement the reforms, and so much less happened. So I think you can expect to see her trying to weave a delicate relationship between the various parties. And of course, she's also going to want to be much closer to her Southeast Asian neighbors, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Vietnam, etc.
And I want to get back to this topic of the Rohingya minority in Myanmar. Is there almost a silver lining to this, that the more democratic and the more open Myanmar becomes, the more it has to face up to this crisis and face up to the way it's treating its minorities?
Wasn't it really ironic that they were allowed to vote, they were allowed to live in their own communities? Of course, there were some outbreaks of violence and unrest, but really the worst violence broke out in 2012 in the middle of the reforms. The rabid anti-Muslim rhetoric by most liberal democratic people, Buddhists in Myanmar, has sprung up since the reforms were launched. It really, now that Aung San Suu Kyi, she has a task of trying to, and she has called already for everybody's rights to be respected, but she has a task of trying to call on nationalists, ultra-nationalist Buddhists who are democratic in many ways, but in the treatment of Rohingya are just awful and just racist, plain and simple. And she's going to have to find a way to try to get them to recognize that when the U.S. and other countries in the world fought to bring democracy, liberalization, free political prisoners, that was not for just Burman, majority Buddhists, but it was all for all people in Myanmar. And I think it's a task that she's going to have to try and tackle and try to gradually build a constituency that will follow her on this.
Burma or Myanmar? What are we supposed to say?
Inside the country, everybody calls it Myanmar, except Aung San Suu Kyi, which will be really interesting. If she's above the president, she's above the head of state, what's she going to call the place? I've been with delegations that have asked her, what should we call the country? She says, most people call it Myanmar. I call it Burma. You choose.
That was Murray Hebert, bringing us to the end of our show for this week. Remember, for any feedback on the show, you can find both me and CSIS on Twitter. Until next week, I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.